this lecture entitled The Maskilim, The Circle of Moses Mendelssohn, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Brim family. As we pointed out in previous lectures, although Moses Mendelssohn was of the opinion that Judaism had no dogmas, and the ultimate truths of mankind can be discovered by one's own rational faculties without the aid of divine revelation, there existed and still exists a wide gulf between many of the ideas that are basic to rationalist enlightenment and the ideas that were widely maintained within the Jewish community in the 18th century. They're still widely maintained within much of the Orthodox community to this day. Since much of the traditionalist and modern thought hinges on these ideas, and those who embrace the ideas popularly held by the enlightened individuals found themselves at odds with the traditionalist Jewish community, it is important to first point them out before we deal in detail with the history of the Haskalah, the Jewish form of the secular enlightenment. Perhaps first and foremost is the idea of human autonomy and religious freedom. On the whole, ancient pagan society was generally tolerant of diversity. Religion was a private matter. The focus of life was happiness in the eyes of the Epicureans, or finding tranquility and peace of mind in the face of adversity, according to the Stoics. It was all about man. The idea that man was a servant or slave of God, and man's life mission was to fulfill God's commandments, is a unique Jewish idea. Even in Christianity, which shares much with Judaism, the focus is on seeking atonement and salvation through belief in Yeshu, not on the fulfillment of a divine mission. In other words, the spirit of enlightenment focused upon man and what would make him feel fulfilled. The focus of Judaism, certainly in its most traditional form, is on fulfilling the will of an all-pervasive yet transcendent God. For this reason, the Torah constantly stresses maintaining relationship with God, fulfilling his mitzvahs, his commandments. As we read, this is on the first page of your notes here. This is on section A and B. This is taken the first from Parshas Bahar. This is in Leviticus 25. For to me, the people of Israel, Avodahim, are servants or slaves. They're my servants whom I brought out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord, your God. And here in Parshas Akev, in section B, this is Deuteronomy chapter 10. It says, V'yata Yisrael ma'ashem alakecha shoyal mimach. Now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you this day for your good. And regarding about the attitude of serving God, here we quote number 2 in the section B. This is from the third mission in Avos. Antigonus of Socho received the oral tradition from Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous. He used to say, don't be like servants who serve their master in order to receive a reward. Rather, be like servants who serve not for the purpose of receiving reward, and let the fear of heaven be upon you. Just as an aside, I once read an article from a Supreme Court judge of Israel, an Orthodox Jew from the early days of the state. Judge Silver was his name. And he said the difference between the Western form of law and the traditional Jewish form of law is in the Western form of law, the focus is on rights. Think of rights. In the Jewish form, it's of responsibilities. What do I have to do? What am I responsible for? It's a whole different focus. Now, to give you a sense of the gulf that divides those who embraced Enlightenment thought and those of traditional religious thought, I'd like to share with you the comments of Immanuel Kant, one of the greatest of the Enlightenment thinkers, who particularly stressed in his works the idea of the moral autonomy of the individual versus mere blind obedience to a higher power. Now, in the eyes of the Torah, the one who most clearly embodies the idea of bittul, of negating oneself and personal interests, and even judgment in the face of the divine will, is our forefather Abraham Avraham Avinu, who is ready to sacrifice his son Yitzchak on the altar, although it violated his own moral code and violated the promise made to him that his seed would continue on through Yitzchak. This is the Torah's description of Avram at the time that he was just told not to sacrifice his son Yitzchak. This is paragraph C. This is taken from the end of Parshas Vayera. This is in Genesis 22. And he said, "Lay not your hand upon the lad, nor do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing that you did not withhold your son, your only son, from me." Now this is what Kant wrote regarding the same incident. Quote, Strittiv Fakultaten. If you want, volume 7, if you want to look this up. Quote, Abraham should have replied to this putative divine voice, quote, "That I may not kill my good son is absolutely certain. But that you appear to me are God is not certain. It cannot become certain, even though the voice were to sound from the very heavens." Unquote. And he continues on, "That a voice which one seems to hear cannot be divine, one can be certain of, in case what is commanded is contrary to moral law." Unquote. This is from Kant. Time doesn't allow me to delve deeper into the unique spiritual experience of prophecy. You know, the people that are schizophrenic also hear voices. But prophecy is a whole different thing. As the Rambam explains well, as so well in his Mishnah Torah, in Hilchos Yesodei Torah, Mirtz Hashem will touch upon in the 10th lecture of this series. Suffice it to say that to Kant and to others of his ilk, total subjugation to the divine will, specifically when it runs counter to one's own rational understanding, is something that he could not in any way tolerate. Now, according to the Torah's guidelines, the responsibility for the fulfillment of mitzvahs does not lie solely on the individual, but on the entire community. As we read here on the bottom of page 1, this is taken from the Gemara in Sanhedrin, from Zion and Beis 27b, it is written, he says, "And they shall," this is in the Toichacha, this is Bechukosai, "and they shall stumble, v'choshlu, ish ba'ofiv, they shall stumble one upon another," which is understood to mean one will stumble through the sin of the other. This teaches us that they are all held responsible for one another. There the reference is to such as had the power to restrain their fellow man from evil, but did not. In other words, if I see someone, I'm aware of someone doing something wrong, and I could have stopped him, I could have given him tzeichocha, I could have given him rebuke, could be moich, I could protest, and I don't, I'm held responsible. But here again we find the idea of communal responsibility. The communal responsibility extends even to the following on the page, on the top of page 2. In the case of positive precepts, mitzvahs aseh, for instance, when a man is told, make a sukkah, does not make it, or perform the commandment of lulav, and does not perform it, he is flogged, makanoisa, and if he persists in his refusal, he is flogged until his soul departs. In a previous lecture, we explained the powers that were exercised by the Jewish community during the pre-modern era, including the cherem, the ban. To give you an example of its use, I quote now from pages 22 to 23 from Professor David Vital's well-researched book, A People Apart, A Political History of the Jews in Europe, 1789 to 1939. This account is based upon the archival material of the historian Simon Dubnov, which in turn is based upon the Pincus, the communal minute book of the community of Amchislov. Now I quote. Consider the case of Yitzhak Rofe, literally doctor, called to order in 1732 by the elders of Amchislov. This is a community in Belarus, then under Polish rule, for his quote-unquote evil conduct. Rofe had aroused his leader's wrath by frequenting members of the local Polish nobility, and horrible to recount, going so far with his wife in tow as to dance with them. Summoned before them to be rebuked, he had further transgressed by failing to treat them with respect that they believed to be their due. On the contrary, he had been so bold as to appear before them in the company of his Polish patron, and, as the communal minute book recorded, speak, quote, wickedly and rudely, unquote, to them, in his Polish protector's hearing and for his benefit. Moreover, and slanderously too. Yitzhak Rofe and his wife, may her name be wiped out, evidently they weren't too fond of her, were thereupon prescribed to be, i.e., put into cherem. No Jew was to enter their dwelling place. None was to break bread with them. Their sons were to be removed from school. Their property was for the taking. By the way, from our previous lecture, which covered the details of a cherem, it would seem that this detail is not true. They were, in effect, placed without the law and beyond the pales, so far as all of Jewry was concerned. And like penalties were imposed on any Jew who was so presumptuous as to violate the terms of the ban in the villain's favor. The Amchislov communal minute book records that Yitzhak responded ferociously to the judgment meted out to him. They expressed himself in, quote, words that cannot be put in writing, unquote. And he went on to compound his original fault and his very great sins by complaining to, quote, to unnamed, quote, rulers who were established enemies of the Jews, unquote, which would mean to be local landowners or churchmen in all probability, bearing false tales to them. At that point, the advantage passed Yitzhak, who so worked on his Polish protectors that one of their number, having ordered the elder of the community to appear before him, set upon the poor man and flogged him near to death and before all. But Yitzhak did not hold the advantage for long, nor was this the end of the story, or as Simon Dubnov observed of the case, where its interest lies. Despite the support and protection accorded him by his Polish patrons, despite, as it appears, their having half accepted him socially, along with his wife, and despite what must have been the fury and indignation of the communal leadership faced with one who, over and above his improper social behavior, had been prepared so flagrantly to violate the rules of group loyalty on which Jewish society had relied from time immemorial, the ban on Yitzhak and his wife was eventually rescinded. When or on what grounds this was done, or even whether it was in the lifetime of the rebellious couple or later at the behest of the children, remains unclear. What is known, because duly noted in the community minute book, is that an act of repentance of some sort was performed and accepted. This is from Dubnov, this is from his history, from his writings. And Professor Zital continues, what can be presumed is that the disgrace proved unbearable even to the evil and unruly Yitzhak Rofe. It can presume too, this was very well understood by the communal authorities and accounts, at least in part, for what they themselves must have regarded as an appropriate display of leniency. Life under ban of excommunication for one who would not or could not bring himself to apostatize was indeed intolerable and in many ways impossible. Unquote. Note that this occurred in the year 1732. By the end of the 18th century, the ban, as a rule, was no longer being exercised in Jewish communities, with the result that those who would want to live an independent lifestyle, like this Yitzhak Rofe, were increasing in number, but were not suffering any consequences. This was due to several factors. One, was it due to the change in the political character of much of Europe, with absolute rulers usurping the prerogatives once exercised by the various estates or sections of the community, as we discussed in a previous lecture. These rulers limited the once independent rulership of the Bezdin within the Jewish community and often completely forbade the use of the cherem, the ban, or at least curtailed its use by demanding prior authorization by the secular authorities before its issuance. Second of all, because of the widespread liberal ideology of the Enlightenment, even when allowed, the use of the ban was discredited by the ever-increasing enlightened public. The historian Professor Jacob Katz, in his excellent work, Out of the Ghetto, page 148, stated, quote, when Raphael Cohen, the revered rabbi of Hamburg, Raphael Hamburger, used the ban against a member of his community in 1780 because the latter publicly desecrated the Sabbath, the rabbi was maligned for it by both Jews and Gentiles alike. Unquote. Although it was sparingly used, the fear of imposing the ban, where Bezdin was still authorized to use it, seems to have still retained a powerful effect upon those who would have contemplated violating halacha, Jewish law. It is noteworthy that the very same time that the Danish government forbade the use of the cherem, the ban, Raphael Cohen resigned his position as chief rabbi of Hamburg. At the time, it was under the auspices of Denmark on Hamburg. Historians view this as no coincidence. The Rav evidently felt that without the use of the cherem, or at least fear of its use, he could no longer exercise authority over the community, a community that was gradually drifting away from its historic roots. In this vein, it is significant to note that Moses Mendelssohn, a prime example of someone who had integrated Enlightenment thought into his worldview, was very much opposed to the use of the cherem, the ban. In the year 1782, in Moses Mendelssohn's preface to a German translation of Rabbi Menashe ben Yisrael's Defense of the Jews, entitled Judaeorum, The Vindication of the Jews, in which Mendelssohn argued, this is in the preface, that the Jews were entitled to full citizenship, irrespective of their private religious views, he also argued against the use of the cherem, rabbinic ban of excommunication. As we read here on page 2, in paragraph F, oh my brothers, you have until now all too severely felt the oppressive yoke of intolerance, and perhaps thought to find compensation in the power granted you to impose an equally severe yoke upon your people. It continues on. If you want to be cherished, tolerated, and spared by others, then cherish, tolerate, and spare one another. These words, despite their beauty, are clearly a departure from the traditional understanding of Judaism, which we pointed out before. This sentiment, in turn, produced a reaction from a surprising source. An anonymously published pamphlet entitled, quote, "The Search for Light and Justice," unquote, challenged Mendelssohn that by denying rabbinical authority to coerce the members of the Jewish community to follow its guidelines, he was, in effect, denying Judaism itself. Although it was actually published, this pamphlet, by August Frederick Krenz, a Christian writer and pamphleteer, it was assumed, at least at the time, that the actual author of the pamphlet was a well-respected Austrian Meshumet convert by the name of Joseph von Sonnenfels. And consequently, Mendelssohn felt the need to publicly reply. His reply was in the form of his most memorable work entitled Jerusalem. We now quote from both the challenge in the pamphlet and the reply. G is from the paragraph, G on page 2 is from the pamphlet. "Clearly, ecclesiastical law, armed with coercive power, has always been one of the cornerstones of the Jewish religion of your fathers. How then can you, my dear Herr Mendelssohn, continue to abide by the faith of your fathers, and by removing the cornerstone, shake the whole edifice, contesting the system of law that was given by Moses, claiming the authority of divine revelation? If it is possible," he continues, "to abolish ecclesiastical privilege, Herem, which is based upon positive Mosaic laws, why should it be impossible to cancel, for the nation's benefit, mere rabbinic measures of late vintage, which creates such detrimental barriers between Jews and Christians?" And it continues on, "Yet you, my most worthy Herr Mendelssohn, have abandoned the faith of your fathers. One more step, and you have become one of us." And this is now, I'm quoting from Jerusalem, this is his reply. "Religion must have no relation to properties and possessions," and it continues on, "under no circumstances may it resort to the methods of compulsion, nor may its members exert compulsion within the church. All its judgments and concerns can only consist of inspiring, teaching, fortifying, and consoling." Continues on, "Either the activities of the church issue out of a free will of the soul, or they amount to nothing at all." And he continues, "For it is impossible for men to possess the right to govern the thoughts of others as if they belong within my private domain." And he concludes, "Let every man who does not disturb the public welfare, who obeys the law, acts righteously towards you and his fellow men, be allowed to speak as he thinks, to pray to God after his own fashion, or after that of his fathers, and to seek eternal salvation where he thinks he may find it." These words speak for themselves. It is evident, though, that a deep chasm separated the outlook of Mendelssohn and those that followed him and the traditional Jewish community. If one were to give some analogy regarding the chasm that divided these groups, one could say that the Jewish tradition views religious life somewhat akin to waging war on the battlefield. Any deserter, one who compromises the troops, is severely reprimanded or punished. Mendelssohn and the other Enlightenment thinkers viewed religious life akin to going to a concert. Some enjoy one kind of music, and others have different tastes. There's no right or wrong. What matters is the effect it has upon the listener. In this lecture, as well as the previous lecture, we have pointed out how the outlook of the philosophers, the thinkers and writers of the Enlightenment, differed from the traditional worldview. The reliance on reason, the brotherhood of man, the emphasis on the individual sense of fulfillment rather on subjugation to a higher power, which we just covered. There is yet another difference between the religious thinkers of the Enlightenment and their traditionalist counterparts. And that is how they view the role of God in this world. The Enlightenment religious thinkers tended to view God as the creator of a harmonious system, but a system that basically could run on its own without divine interference. Thus, the tragedies that befall mankind, both tragedies created by other human beings and those created by natural causes, were considered by these thinkers to be necessary evils in order to maintain a world that would allow free will. Some 30 years ago, a bestseller by the title When Bad Things Happen to Good People dealt with the same issues and was generally based upon such thinking. In the words of Mendelssohn, here on the bottom of page 2, those who feel that things are badly arranged in this life and in disarray with regards to divine justice do not realize that along with the kind of mechanistic order that would like to they would like to see in this world would go the disappearance of all moral values, all virtue and righteousness. In a world where everything would be meticulously arranged according to their notions of divine justice, all virtue would be rewarded, and every act that is morally good would have to result in some corresponding material good. Virtue would never suffer, vice never triumph. But in such a world, there would be no opportunity to show pity, patience, generosity, or steadfastness, or to engage in the protection, delivery of the virtuous, or in a fight to the death for friends or country. And whatever virtue might still be pursued would be neither noble nor lovable, nor would vice be ignoble or repulsive. For the former would become profitable, you're immediately rewarded, the latter harmful, immediately punished, and anything one might say about virtue would appear as no more than part of the divine economy. Just makes sense, you'll get rewarded. Now, much of what Mendelssohn wrote on this subject is in agreement with traditional Jewish thought. Punishment is not meted out immediately in this world, and good is not immediately rewarded in order to ensure free will. But there's something that is inherent in traditional Jewish thinking that is missing in Mendelssohn's writings. Mendelssohn was deeply influenced by the philosophy of Baron Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz, who maintained that the world was designed by a benevolent creator to produce the maximum good. But it seems, according to their opinion, that once the world was designed, it followed a natural course based upon the laws of nature without divine interference. In Leibniz's world, this world is the best of all possible worlds. This view was mercilessly satirized by Voltaire in a brilliant work entitled Candide. This Candide, a disciple of Professor Pangloss, like Pangloss says, everything is glossy, everything is shining, who was supposedly, you know, in this work, a disciple of Leibniz, originally viewed the world through rose-colored glasses. But as he experienced tragedy after tragedy, earthquakes, the Spanish Inquisition, shipwrecks, crimes of all sorts, he finally comes around to reject Professor Pangloss's worldview of this being the best of all possible worlds, and asks his mentor, quote, if this is the best of all possible worlds, what are the others like? Unquote. The Torah's view, however, is that God, the Creator, is constantly involved in the world that he created, and every tragic act, even a natural act, is in fact one that has been decided upon on high in order to either dispense justice to the victim or as a nesoyin or challenge for the person to overcome. In addition, according to the doctrine of reincarnation, Gilgal, what you see of a person's life is not necessarily the entire picture, as this life may only be the newest of a whole series of lives which is stretched over a long period of time. Person who appears to be guiltless may have a long history behind him stretching over several lifetimes. Since the subject is quite complex, I would just briefly give you some of the sources that touch upon this issue. Here, as on page 3, on paragraph B. Rav Chanina bar Papa gave the following explanation. The name of the angel who is in charge of conception is Lila, night. And he takes up the drop, the embryo, and places in the presence of the Holy One, blessed be He, saying, Sovereign of the universe, what shall be the fate of this drop? Shall it produce a strong man or a weak man? A wise man or a fool? A rich man or a poor man? All of this is predetermined. Now, as a person can be wealthy, strong, intelligent, this is all predetermined. Whereas a wicked man or righteous one, he does not mention. In agreement with the view of Rabbi Chanina, for Rabbi Chanina stated, everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. As people, we have free will. But others, the other things beyond our free will to make moral choices is determined by God. Now here we're dealing with something which is predetermined. In paragraph C, we deal with things which occur on a day-to-day basis. The same Rabbi Chanina, who said, HaKol Bidei Shemayim, Chutz Miyiras Shemayim, everything is in the hands of heaven, except the fear of heaven, states in the Gemara and Fulin, in Zion Amud Beis, in 7b, Chanina said, no one bruises his finger here on earth unless it was so decreed against him in heaven. And he quotes a pasuk. In other words, even that which happens on a day-to-day basis is micromanaged. And it affects not only humans, at least according to what we're going to quote now in paragraph D, it affects the animal world as well. The Tosfos in Avodah Zarah and Tezayin Amud Beis in 16b says the following. The Talmud Yerushalmi in Shvius in chapter 9 records the following incident. After Rav Shimon bar Yochai left the cave, he saw a trapper of birds attempt to capture his prey. And he was there over a decade. He says, and heard that at the very moment the heavenly voice, as he was about to and as a trapper was about to trap, he heard, you know, a divine voice. When the voice said compassion, says, the bird would escape. And when the heavenly voice said trap it, it would be captured. And it continues on, I understand from this, Rav Shimon said, that even a relatively insignificant bird cannot be trapped without divine sanction. Most certainly a person cannot be harmed without such sanction, and he felt safer to leave the cave. As the reason he had really escaped is because he had spoke ill of the Roman occupation, and he was sentenced to death, and he had to flee, and as he fled with his son into the cave. But in terms of his reluctance to leave after being there 12, 13 years, it says this incident, that he's in the hands of God. But here, from this, at least, he's according to Yerushalmi, even the animal world is micromanaged. And here we find in paragraph E, even the plant world. Rav Shimon said, this is from the Medrash Bereishis Rabba, every single blade of grass has a mazel, divine force, or an angel in heaven, which strikes it and tells it, grow. And he quotes a pasuk. The idea of micromanagement is really one of the things which is stressed in Hasidic thought. Mendel says, Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, this is in a Sefer Priya Oritz, it articulates an idea which really stems from the Baal Shem Tov. And he says as follows, behold, in truth, evil people find it very difficult to believe that special divine providence extends even to the fact that a person doesn't bruise his finger, nor does any blade of grass dry up and become uprooted, nor is any stone thrown unless it was destined to do so in that specific time and place. As it is stated, it quotes from the Ecclesiastes, in the place where the tree falls, there it was destined to lie. Nor did any movement occur, however greater and significant, from the first tzimtzum, that's a concentration of divine light, until the lowest of the levels on earth and below the earth, without it coming from Him, may He be blessed, according to His wisdom, through His name, and for His glory, to reveal His divinity and wisdom. But again, it's the idea that we are being micromanaged. In paragraph G, there's the notion that not everything that we feel is bad, or just something which is capricious, is really bad. And here it quotes the following, Zimor Nidin Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph, in 31a. Rabbi Yosef gave the following exposition. What is the meaning of the scriptural text? This is from Isaiah, this is chapter 12. I will give thanks unto you, O Lord, for though you are angry with me, your anger is turned away, and you comfort me. The text alludes to two men who were about to travel by ship on a business venture when a thorn got into the foot of one of them who began to blaspheme and to revile because he missed the ship due to his injuries. They were going on a commercial venture, he and his friend. His friend went on the venture. He, because of what had occurred, the medical emergency, was forced to forego the trip, and he was very angry. After a time, however, when he heard that his friend's ship had sunk into the sea, he began to laud and praise him. Hence it is written, your anger is turned away and you comfort me. This is indeed in line with Rabbi Lozer stated, what is implied by the scriptural text, who does wondrous things alone and blessed be his glorious names forever. The idea of he does wondrous things alone, even the person from whom a miracle is performed is unaware of the miracle. In other words, things occur in a person's life, just you look at it, just happenstance. This is all planned. And very often it's planned for the good. And just to conclude this, I just want to quote from the beginning of this, from the Ramban in Parshas Bo. Through the great open miracles, and those that are recorded in Scripture, one comes to admit the hidden miracles which constitute the foundation of the whole Torah. For no one can have a part in the Torah of Moses, our teacher, unless he believes that all our words and our events, as dictated in the Torah, are miraculous in scope, there being no natural or customary way of the world in them, whether affecting the public or the individual. Instead, if a person observes the commandments, his reward will bring him success. If he violates them, his punishment will cause his extinction. It is all by decree of the Most High, as I've already mentioned. And he continues on. But again, the traditional Jewish thought has it, that which is not unaffected by both the Greek thought or the thought of the Enlightenment, is that God is intimately involved in our lives. And I said these sources are by no means exhaustive, but suffice it to say that by and large they represent the opinion of traditional or non-enlightened Jews during the 18th century. For the enlightened Jew, God was quite distant, perhaps to be called upon to interfere when needed, but not directly involved in the world. For the non-enlightened Jew of the ghetto, however, God was constantly involved in their lives. Another area in which Enlightenment thought diverged from what was then mainstream thought within the Jewish community, and is still maintained by the majority of Orthodox Jews, myself included, is regarding the existence of an unseen spiritual world, a world occupied by angels and demons, in which witchcraft and astrology were forces to reckon with. Although a simple reading of both Scripture and Talmud would seem to indicate that Judaism assumed the validity of such a world, the intellectual world that was influenced by the teachings of Aristotle and the other philosophers of the classic era denied their validity. Rambam, Maimonides, the subject of previous lectures, was one of many prominent thinkers in the Middle Ages who accepted the Greek philosophical worldview, a view that was accepted by the intelligentsia of the Arab world, as we covered in previous lectures. To give you a sense of these different views, let us now read, this is in section 3, in page 5, from the Radak. This is taken from the Radak's commentary to Shmuel Aleph, the first book of Samuel, chapter 28, where it's described how Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, visited a Balas Ov, a medium, and asked her to communicate with the deceased prophet Samuel Shmuel HaNavi. He appeared and told Shaul, this is Shmuel HaNavi, that he would die the next day on the battlefield. Now, let's begin. We have seen an argument between the Gaonim in this matter, how to interpret this verse. The Gaonim, by the way, the Gaonim that he's referring to are those Rashi Yeshiva, heads of the yeshivas in Babel, today's Iraq, at the end of the first millennium of the Common Era, such as Rav Sadia Gaonim or Shmuel Bar Chofni. They were the Gaonim, the Rosh Yeshiva of Surah, and Rav Hai Gaon, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva in Pompadisa, who also flourished at the beginning of the second millennium. So we continue on. All of them agree that necromancy, Maisa Oiv, is total nonsense and charlatanry. There are those that say, however, that Shaul did not speak to Shmuel. And God forbid that Shmuel did not arise from his grave and did not speak. Rather, the woman did everything with trickery, for she immediately recognized that it was Shaul. She only feigned not recognizing him in order to add credibility to her assumed powers. This is the commentary of Shmuel Bar Chofni Gaon, a blessed memory. In addition, he commented that even though the simple meaning of the statement of the sages of blessed memory in the Talmud is that the woman truly did bring to life Shmuel, such things are not acceptable when they can contradict reason. And then he felt that reason would override the statement in the Talmud. However, Rav Sadia Gaon, Rav Hai Gaon of blessed memories say that it actually did occur. For it's far-fetched to say that the woman would know the future. In other words, and even though, this is according to them, that it does not work, the Creator, whoever resurrected Shmuel in order to tell Shaul all that would befall him. Uniquely it worked then. Radak comments, there is room to question the opinions of the Gaonim, however, and he continues on, in addition, if the practice of necromancy is merely a hoax, how was all of this hidden from Shaul, who was a wise man and a king, and who had with him many brilliant advisors? How could he have erred so? We must therefore conclude that the correct explanation is how we explained previously, the necromancy, the contacting the dead, really works and is not a hoax. But the others who were influenced by the Greek thinking maintains that it was a hoax. This reminds me of the story, I thought I have told this in the class, a story that Arafat, shortly before his death, came to a fortune teller. You know, a gypsy with a crystal ball, and asked, when is he going to die? And she looked into the crystal ball. She looked up and says, you're going to die on a Jewish holiday. Which holiday? Whenever you die, it will be a Jewish holiday. I'd like to quote now from the Rambam. This is in his essay, this is a Maimer Tchias HaMeisim, which again we see his mode of thought. And it's interesting to note that Mendelssohn initially was very much influenced by the Rambam. Later on, he expanded his thinking, and the thinking of Leibniz and Wolff. And I quote from the Rambam in his Maimer Tchias HaMeisim: our efforts, as well as the efforts of every unique individual, is the opposite of the efforts of the masses of those that study Torah. That which is to them beloved and that which is sweet to their distorted intelligence is to place the Torah and reason as two polar opposites that are in direct contradiction. Any statement in the Talmud or Medrash which runs contrary to reason, they say, is clearly a miracle. They flee from interpreting a passage that could be explained in a non-supernatural manner. This applies to stories of the past, of the present, or predictions of the future events. We, on the other hand, try to bring together Torah and reason and interpret things in a way which follows the natural course of events. This excludes those passages that are clearly referring to miracles and cannot in any way be understood differently. In those cases, we are forced to say that they are truly miracles. I would just like to quote just very briefly here, because of time we can't quote everything. On page 7, it's really from the first paragraph in the English, from the 10th line from the top, the last two words begin, this is from the Rambam, this is Mishnah Torah and Hilchos Avodah Zarah in chapter 11. Men of wisdom whose knowledge is perfect know, based upon clear proofs, that all of these things which the Torah forbade are not matters of wisdom and science, but rather things based upon imagination and fantasy, which people of low intelligence found attractive and abandoned all the ways of truth because of them. Because of this, the Torah prohibited those fantasies with the words, "You shall be perfect with the Lord your God and not be involved in any form of witchcraft." But this is the Rambam's view. I would just like to turn the page here on page 8. You can look yourself from the various quotes here from the Rambam, from the Gemara. But here I quote on paragraph G on page 8, I quote from the Vilna Gaon, from the Bir HaGron, his comments and his notes to the Shulchan Aruch. This is in Yoredeya Simen Kufayin Tes 179. Rambam was attracted by the teachings of philosophy. Similarly, he wrote that sorcery, names of spiritual beings, incantations, demons, and amulets are all false. And he continues on, philosophy lured him by its great attraction to explain the passages of the Talmud as allegories to uproot them from their simple meaning. God forbid. I do not believe in them to any extent. Rather, all of these passages are to be understood literally. There is, however, a deeper meaning to these passages, but it is not the deeper meaning of the philosophers who actually only deal with externals, but rather the teachings of the masters of truth, referring to the Kabbalah. Now, the worldview of the Gaonim and the Rambam, the Greek influence intellectual world of their contemporaries, was never embraced by the Ashkenazic Jews of the Middle Ages, and was generally not the worldview of those Sephardic Jews who refused to convert to Catholicism and gave up their wealth and often their lives to move to a country that was hospitable to the practice of Judaism. Thus, up until the middle of the 18th century, the worldview of the Ashkenazic communities of Germany, France, and Poland was similar to the previous quoted passages from the Vilna Gaon. This view, however, was in sharp contrast to those who were influenced by the Enlightenment. The philosophers of the Enlightenment, who maintained that for all practical purposes, existence is strictly limited to that which we see or sense, and anything else is merely a figment of a fertile imagination, to be dismissed and ridiculed, found confirmation of their views in the writings of the Greek and Roman philosophers. In addition, as Epicurus pointed out, a secular and naturalistic view of the world, which denies both an afterlife and or a world occupied by spirits, limits one's worries to only that which we see in the here and now. Their attitude, which by the way is the attitude of today's secular thinkers, is probably best summed up by the Greek philosopher and writer Plutarch, who lived in the first century of the Common Era in his essay entitled On Superstition, and I quote, "He who is afraid of the gods is afraid of everything, the sea, the air, sky, darkness, light, a call, silence, a dream," end quote. Regarding an afterlife, Plutarch wrote, quote, "The appointed end of life for all men is death, but for superstition, not even death is a limit. It leaps over the boundaries of life into the other side, making fear long lived than life, and tacking on to death the imagination of never-ending troubles," end quote. In other words, the denial of the supernatural not only made scientific sense for the philosophers, as the supernatural cannot be seen or tested and was not part of their experience, but this denial made psychological sense as well. Even for those enlightened religious thinkers like Mendelssohn and many of his circle who were practicing Jews and believed in an afterlife, their worldview was very different than the mainstream Jewish community, including the Torah scholars amongst them, and was closer to their non-Jewish enlightened colleagues. Since the belief in Ruach Ra, evil spirits, and Mazel was just somewhat tied to astrology, those Jews who embraced the enlightened view of the world were extremely uncomfortable with those practices that are somehow tied to these supernatural beliefs. Reformed Judaism was still in its infancy, but coming into its own, when the following letter was written, during the first half of the 19th century. The anonymous letter was published in the year 1837, the Allgemeine Zeitung des Judentums, the General Journal of Judaism, a magazine published by one of the leading Reform rabbis in Germany, Ludwig Philipson. And I quote, "Has the borderline between faith and superstition been clearly and unmistakably been delineated? Have we created a bulwark against importation of new twaddle? Does Israel's church have fewer superstition than those religions which do not twice daily proclaim that God is uniquely one? I fear we have easily as many. In vain did Jeremiah call, warn, and plead that we should not be like other nations. But what do we do when we conclude a marriage? Certain days must be chosen. There's a fear of Monday, not sure. There's hesitation to get married when the moon wanes. There's a bad reputation of the first week of Av." I mean, that has nothing to do with marriage, some, because of the Avelus, because the morning one can't get married in the first week of Av. But it has to do with business deals. "And many more superstitions which are in general use and which our ecclesiastical officials formally tolerate and recognize. Astrological tomfoolery is brought into play even where the biblical texts themselves have long suffered from the acid of philological criticisms. Yet, where's the pious man who doubts the dictum? You know, Mishana Mokka, Mishana Maz. He who changes his place also changes his lucky star. Where's the rabbi who congratulates others except with the words Mazel Tov?" Which means the Mazel, the constellation. This should be good. "Who denounces the belief in fatefully happy and unhappy people, places, and houses. And are not the simonim, on Rosh Hashanah, the omens and dream interpretations permitted by law? In vain did Moses in his Old Testament, in chapter Hazinu, call heaven and earth as witnesses against the people who turn to the idols. The New Testament of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid is being more meticulously observed than the former. Even today, it will interfere with the love of young people if the first name of the man is the same as the first name of the girl's father." This is end quote. It's a long letter. The writer goes on and on. The thrust of the letter is that unless Judaism reforms itself and rids itself of what the writer conceives to be foolishness, Judaism is doomed. And he writes, quote, "If you want to keep your children as Jews, then gentlemen, attack and jump into the breach," end quote. By the mid-1800s, the majority of the youth had been thoroughly immersed in secular thought and had relatively little exposure to traditional Jewish scholarship or belief. It was they who found the Reform movement most attractive. It goes without saying that in the period under discussion in the latter half of the 18th century, that those Jews who accepted the Enlightenment viewpoint were quite estranged from the core Jewish community and were, in fact, quite amenable to the suggestion that Judaism should undergo some change to conform to this new mode of thought. With this, we can better understand Mendelssohn's sentiments reflected in the following. Here at the bottom of page 8. I cannot deny, however, that I have discovered certain wholly human additions and abuses, which, alas, badly tarnish the original luster in my religion. All of us who, in our search for truth, wish we could wipe out such poisonous accretions without doing damage to all that is authentic and good in our religion. And I'll probably be referring to that which he would refer to being as being superstitious. And he writes in another place, for this reason, all of our endeavors should have only one goal, to do away with misuses that have crept into these ceremonies, to fuse them with a genuine, authentic meaning. This way, the original script, blurred beyond recognition by hypocrisy and clerical ruse, might become legible and intelligible once again. Although these were also the sentiments of Mendelssohn's followers and admirers, many decades would pass before these sentiments would actually be instituted in Jewish life. By the time these cosmetic changes into Jewish life were instituted by the Reform movement, their followers, those who had integrated the principles of the Enlightenment to their worldview, had for the most part abandoned their commitment to the whole halakhic system of Jewish law, were very far removed even from Mendelssohn's level of commitment and observance of Judaism. Now, just as an aside, the fact that something is not readily observable doesn't necessarily prove its non-existence. Doesn't prove its existence, but doesn't prove its non-existence. Take radioactivity, for example, or electromagnetic waves such as radio waves. In the 18th century, even for most of the 19th century, they were not observable. Yet, they most certainly did exist then. Scientists today, for various reasons, theorize the existence of an infinite number of parallel universes, all unseen and unseeable, or the existence of multiple dimensions as part of string theory, also unobservable. Although the belief in a spirit world has been widely dismissed by the secular community, there exists a plethora of evidence to support such beliefs. Such a discussion, however, goes beyond the scope of this particular lecture and series, but you should know that not everything that is easily observable is the limitations of existence. Now, although there were Jews even before Mendelssohn who were acquainted with Western philosophy and science, such as Aaron Gumpertz, whom Mendelssohn greatly admired, it was Dr. Gumpertz, while still in medical school, who introduced Mendelssohn to the Enlightenment philosopher Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. Their numbers were quite small. With a newfound glimmer of hope that eventually Enlightenment thinking would spread across Western Europe and the Jews would finally be accepted as citizens and equal in society, especially after the publication of Christian Dom's essay regarding granting the Jews equal rights, which we discussed in the previous lecture, Mendelssohn himself began to take the lead in ushering in this new era of enlightenment within the Jewish community and, in a very subtle way, began proselytizing and spreading his vision amongst the wider Jewish community. Although we have pointed out, based upon the sources, that the philosophy of the Enlightenment was far removed from the traditional philosophy of the Torah, in Mendelssohn's mind, there was no contradiction between commitment to the Torah and embracing Gentile society and culture as a whole. And in order to have that happen, Mendelssohn felt it was essential that the Jews themselves remove themselves from the parochial mindset of the ghetto and shtetl and make the effort to share in the common language and culture of their respective communities. But in order that the world at large accept them, Mendelssohn and those of his school realized that the old system of education, which focused almost solely upon the study of the Talmud and did not include the study of mathematics, science, and the humanities, would have to change. In its place, a new system, which would give the students a broad education, would have to be implemented. In other words, the cost of emancipation was the creation of a new enlightened Jew, A Jew, however, who generally would possess only a smattering of Talmudic knowledge, if that. The process had already began as the wealthiest Jews, especially the court Jews, who wished that their children be integrated in society, provided them with a secular education. Poorer Jews, who could not afford such tutors, were taught in the traditional chadorim, Jewish communal schools that stressed the study of Chumash, the five books of Moses, and the Talmud. In the year 1778, David Friedlander, considered by many as Mendelssohn's most ardent disciple, founded his Freischule, free school in Berlin, to educate those Jewish students who couldn't afford a private tutor. The curriculum included the study of, quote, Hebrew, German, French, all grammatically taught, arithmetic and mechanics, geography, history, and science, end quote. This school received the active support of Mendelssohn, who contributed to the Lesbuch für Yiddische Kinder, a student reader which was composed by Friedlander. Eventually, this model was copied in other cities within Germany as well. In the year 1781, Emperor Joseph II of Austria issued a document entitled the Edict of Tolerance. The preamble to the edict read, quote, our preeminent attention being directed to the end that all our subjects without distinction of nationality and religion, once they become admitted and tolerated in our states, shall participate in common and public welfare, shall enjoy legal freedom and encounter no obstacles to any honest way of gaining their livelihood and of increasing general industriousness, end quote. Although the document hinted at eventually granting his Jewish subjects equal rights, it didn't actually grant it to them. What this Edict of Tolerance did, however, was to facilitate the process of making them citizens in the future by making them, quote, useful and serviceable to the state, mainly through education and enlightenment of its youth, by directing them to the sciences, the arts, and the crafts, end quote. In the words of Professor Jacob Katz, and this is out of the Ghetto, page 162, the edict contained a prescription that Jewish communities had to establish schools for their children's civic education, and where this was unfeasible, Christian schools were obligated to take in Jewish pupils. Institutions for secondary schooling and higher learning had to be open for Jews, but they would be spared contact with religious teaching. The special emblem of the Jews and the particular Jewish dress could now be discarded. The body tax Jews had to pay on going from one place to another was abolished. A Jew would now be permitted to learn handicrafts and to be encouraged to open factories. Jews were free to seek apprenticeships with Christian masters if they wished, but the guilds retained their rights to exclude Jews, and Jewish artisans would therefore have to work on their own. In Bohemia, Jews were also allowed to take a lease on land for 20 years, but in order to actually acquire it, they had to become Christians. End quote from Katz. Now, although the Jews still remained second-class citizens, as their rights were still limited, and in addition, in Moravia and Bohemia, the Jews were only allowed a certain number of marriages in order to limit their numbers, akin to what Pharaoh attempted to do with the Jews, nevertheless, they were granted some measure of recognition. It is evident from the edict, though, that the government wished to assimilate the Jews into their general society, and to that end, they demanded they receive a secular education. Now, those few Jews who are already secularly inclined, such as the Circle of Mendelssohn, view the edict as a wonderful step to bring enlightenment to the entire Jewish community. They also hoped that thereby the non-Jewish world would accept and embrace them. That dream was unevenly fulfilled, witness the Holocaust. The traditional community, however, was understandably alarmed as their isolation from non-Jewish society and the unique education that the Jewish community offered had served them well to ensure that the Jews remained the people of the Torah and concentrate their God-given talents to study of the Chumash, Talmud, and related areas. Even Mendelssohn himself had mixed feelings toward the Austrian government's official attempt at assimilating the Jews through education, as he feared, rightly so, the ultimate lead to conversion to Christianity, an unstated goal of the Edict of Toleration. And I quote here, you can see this, on page 9, I quote from what Moses Mendelssohn writes to Hertz Homburg. Hertz Homburg was a friend of his. They eventually worked together on the Biur, the commentary translation of the Torah. It was Mendelssohn's translation. We're going to discuss this in the future lecture. But Homburg was in Deuteronomy. He gave he gave part of the translation. And eventually, this Hertz Homburg became the superintendent of the Austrian schools in Galicia. But he writes here that Mendelssohn writes that he's afraid that this is just a ploy for them to convert the Jews. He quote also, you can just take a look again, time doesn't allow. But we quote here on page 10 from the Beis Halevi. This is from Yosef Doiber Soloveitchik. He was the Rav in Brisk. He passed away in the year 1892. Which he writes, I'll just summarize this, that Yaakov's fear, when Esav, his brother Esav, came, he says, save me from Esav, miyad ochi miyad Esav, from my brother of Esav, he was afraid of two things. He was afraid that he would act out of enmity and attack him, but he was afraid that he would show brotherly love. And that brotherly love would cause Yaakov to be one with Esav and to compromise his principles. And this is how he writes this in great detail. And he was very much relieved, Yaakov, when Esav not only did Esav not harm him, but he immediately left him. So Yaakov was free to maintain his own lifestyle. You could look, it's a beautiful, I translated this, it's a beautiful piece. Now, although Mendelssohn, who was originally, says, a Talmudic scholar, had serious reservations regarding the Edict of Toleration, others of his circle viewed this as a tremendous opportunity to spread the light of Western culture and knowledge to their backward brethren. Realizing the traditional Jewish community would resist the blandishments of a secular education emancipation, Naftali Herz Wiesel, known as Hartwig Wesseli, a banker who was also a gifted poet, grammarian, linguist, biblical commentator, and a close friend of Mendelssohn's, wrote a pamphlet entitled Divrei Shalom Ve'Emes, Words of Peace and Truth. Based on assumptions that were central to his Enlightenment view of secular education, such as the assumption that Talmudic scholars who don't possess secular knowledge, who are not equally proficient in both Hebrew and German language and grammar, are useless to general society and are therefore a dishonor to the Jewish community, this pamphlet was received far and wide throughout most of the Jewish world with alarm and condemnation. I'd like to quote to you some key passages from the work, from Wesseli's work. Here, just on page, see, this just summarizes. He referred to secular education as Torah's Odom, the Torah, which is common to all humanity, which is general studies. He says, Torah's Odom takes precedence in time to the study of the higher divine statutes. In other words, this children should first study, be well grounded in general studies before they begin their Talmudic study. The study of Torah Sodom will prepare the person to eventually excel in the higher Torah studies. The divine statutes of Torah are much loftier than the Torah Sodom, where the Torah Sodom ends as the divine Torah begins, and informs of matters which are not within the grasp of any human. Now, Wesseli, the Wiesel, was a committed Jew. It wasn't that he was not. However, it says that he felt that in light of the opportunities, in light of his own philosophy, he felt that the best means of education is to first to give him a thorough secular education, and then so to continue on with a Talmudic education. And he, on page 12, again in his Divrei Sholem Vamos, he explains, if after the beginning, before the Talmudic education begins, if the school administration judges a pupil to be unfit for the study of Mishnah or Talmud, they're going to study one of the professions and trades that he finds satisfying. He should increase his time instead in the study of Scripture and Musar, religious ethics. He continues on, through this manner, everyone will be successful, each person according to his ability and future profession. He continues, those who are also successful in the study of Talmud become the great Torah scholars of the land. And it continues, to their broad understanding, they will gain a clear understanding of the various subjects of the Talmud. After all, not everyone is designed to become a Talmudic scholar. Now, although these sentiments may find some sympathetic ears today, even amongst practicing Orthodox Jews, that was certainly not the case amongst the mainstream traditional community when this new educational system was proposed. To give you a sense of the reaction amongst the rabbinic leadership of the Jewish community to the Divrei Sholem Vamos, I quote you a sampling. Here. This is from Rabbi Yecheskel Landau. This is the chief rabbi of the known as Noyde Behuda, chief rabbi of Prague. This heretic, Rosselli, may his name and memory be blotted. An evil, unscrupulous person, continues on, an enemy of the Jewish people. Never has an enemy like that arisen from amongst the Jewish people who's been so brazen as to remove any pretense of shame from his face and to write, sign, and testify against himself that he has no part in God or his Torah. I publicly degraded him by name and stated he is cursed, damned, and utterly cut off from the community of Israel. Anyone who banishes him and treats him like an abomination will be blessed by heaven. This was a letter, this is from Yecheskel Landau, to a rav in the community in Vienna. The following is from a rav, a goyim of David Tevely, who was the chief rabbi of Lisa. I see the evil perpetrated by that flatter and evil one, impoverished of mind, the greatest of ignoramuses, whose name is Hertz Vaseli, from the holy community of Berlin, who published a pamphlet filled with slick and polished statements, offering advice to the wise and discerning, to the unblemished and perfect, as if he were the most outstanding sage of his generation. He continues on, I felt very consoled upon hearing from reliable sources, the holy city of Vilna, the great city unto God, they burned this work in the town square after having it first hung by an iron neck chain used to humiliate criminals in the courtyard of the synagogue. And this is on page 13 in a drusha from Pinchas Horvitz, chief rabbi of Frankfurt, this is Amen, the author of the Haflaw. I've heard that many holy communities have burned these works. In Vilna they burned in public view. Meritorious before the Master, the Holy King, is the portion of those who are jealous on behalf of the Lord of Hosts. And now this is how Vaseli himself described the reaction to his work. This is a letter from Vaseli, the Holy Spirit Vaseli, to the heads of the Jewish community of Trieste. While we were still rejoicing over the Edict of Tolerance issued by Emperor Joseph II of Austria, we received written reports from the cities of Vilna and Prague that our brethren were sitting and crying, declaring a day of fasting, for they consider it to be a time of distress. When this pamphlet, Divrei Sholem Vamos, reached Prague, where Yecheskel Landau went and came out publicly against in the synagogue with language as sharp as a honed razor. He also opposed the translation of our beloved friend, Rav Moshe Mendelssohn, may God protect him. The rabbinic opposition wrote polemic attacks against it and sent it to all the Jewish communities of Germany and Poland. Continuing on, the fury of the Rabbonim has reached tremendous proportions as they publicly burned our pamphlet. The Rav of Lisa, Rav David Tevely, expounded in a drush on Shabbos that the pamphlet needs to be burned and the other works I composed need to be put away in hiding. There are three major chief opponents. One is the Rav of Posen. This is the Rav of Goyim Rav Yosef, the son-in-law of the chief rabbi of Prague, Yecheskel Landau. The second is the chief rabbi of Lisa, of David Tevli. And the third is a person who lives in Vilna by the name of Elia Chosid. This is the Vilna Gaon. These are the ones who wrote letters filled with hostility and rage to the chief rabbi of this city, in Berlin, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Levin. And he continues, without specifically detailing what wrongs they found in our pamphlet, they only said, "It is my desire to destroy and uproot all of the house of Israel through these means." Although historians today feel that Wesley never intended to destroy Judaism and really felt that his educational reforms would not only preserve Talmudic study, but also enable those who don't have the intellectual ability to excel in Talmudic studies to find a satisfaction in Judaic as well as general knowledge, his critics understood, however, that without the emphasis on the Talmud and its commentaries, the Jewish community would not have the spiritual strength to continue their historic mission of being God's people. Even Wesley himself, towards the end of his life, after seeing the effects of the New Enlightenment philosophy on the Jewish populace, is quoted as having said on page 14, "Judaism survived for thousands of years without having to come on to Mendelssohn's work Phaedon to prove the existence of the soul and its survival after death. While just one generation of Haskalah, Enlightenment was enough to undermine the bulwark of Judaism." In other words, traditional Judaism, the way it was, survived. The changed Judaism did not. We have yet to discuss, Mirz Hashem will be next year, the steps taken by those of the school of Sham Shemful Hirsch, who did find a means of embracing both, but in a very different way than the Enlightenment thinkers. To give you a sense of how this new educational philosophy successfully changed the face of Berlin Jewry, let me quote to you from a letter written by David Friedlander, the organizer and supervisor of the Freie Schule. This is the free school, a Jewish school where the ideals of Enlightenment philosophy was taught. This letter was written in March 30th, 1788. Quote, "The Talmud is no longer studied. We have no yeshivas. Our rabbis are, thank God, powerless. In 10 years, no one in Berlin will know anything at all about the Talmud," end quote. Now, despite the furor and antagonism against Wesley's writings, schools for Jews offering secular education were in fact established throughout the Austrian Empire, but they were generally controlled and limited by the Jewish community, who continued to offer the same traditional Torah education to their communities without compromising their values. In other words, they provided secular education, but in addition provided the same traditional, like basically as our yeshivas today. Nonetheless, alternate schools, similar to the Freie Schule in Berlin, continued to be established and were led by educators whose goal was to produce secularly enlightened Jewish students. Galicia, an area presently divided between Poland and the Ukraine, was annexed by Austria in the year 1772. Near 1787, a year after the passing of Moses Mendelssohn, the Austrian emperor named Hertz Homburg, which we quoted, which we referred to in the letter before, as a supervisor of the German Jewish schools in Galicia. An avowed missionary for the cause of spreading the Enlightenment amongst his so-called benighted relatives, he was originally a Talmud disciple of Rabbi Goyim Rabbi Cheska Landau, the author of Neude Behuda, and later, after becoming influenced by the Enlightenment, became a tutor for Mendelssohn's children, as well as a contributor to Mendelssohn's Bier. The Bier was Mendelssohn's translation and commentary to the Torah. As supervisor of the proposed Jewish schools with a secular orientation, Homburg experienced much resistance from the local Jewish populace, both amongst the Hasidim and their opponents, the Misnagdim. In the process of battling for his educational reforms, he personally forsook Jewish observance and bitterly waged war against the Jewish establishment. His vision was to replace traditional Judaism with a secularized form of Judaism similar to what eventually would be known as Radical Reform Judaism. Hamber's effects were met with little success in Galicia, and he was eventually forced to abandon the project. He retired to Prague, where he severed his ties with the rest of the Jewish community. To give you an idea how far he had fallen since his days as a student of Reheskel Landau, in a petition that Hamber sent to the Austrian government, he proudly stated that four of his sons had already converted to Christianity. His five other sons were still Jews. Now, as the secular movement within the Jewish community grew, more schools in the spirit of enlightenment opened up. The effects of these schools and the philosophy of their educators will be discussed in future lectures. During the period under discussion, during the lifetime of Moses Mendelssohn, those of his circle seem to have still maintained, at least outwardly, traditional Jewish observance. After his lifetime, however, the relations between the so-called enlightened ones, or maskilim, and the traditional community was even further strained, as is evident from the letter of resignation tendered by the chief rabbi of Berlin, a rabbi going to Hirsch Levin. Here, this is in the bottom of the last quote here on page 14. "Is my desire to return to my homeland," referring to Poland, "for although there are many who remain God-fearing, terrified to violate his commandments, there has recently been an increase in the number of the ignorant who are on the fringes of the community who are lax in their godly duties and transgress that which is forbidden or guilty of abominations. Besides that which my eyes beheld, did my ears hear." It continues on, "Behold, your honor has prevailed upon me. They said it would be better for me to stay with them, and even the situation does not improve, at least it won't get worse. I said the time will tell. I had hoped to produce grapes and fine disciples, but on the contrary, there has newly come people whose whole ambition is to remove the crown of Israel, and now what reason is there for me to remain here?" In the next lecture, we'll continue with the story of Moses Mendelssohn, his circle, and their influence. We'll also return to the events in France and their far-reaching effect upon the Jewish communities throughout Europe. So now, are there any questions?
It seems that they came to add secular studies out of the wrong motives. Had they had the right motives for secular studies, would the establishment have accepted it?
Now you're asking, you're asking, had they introduced it for the right secular education, not based on Enlightenment philosophy, but just on the practicality of making a living and be able to involve in society? At that time, there was the fear that they couldn't control it. Since there was this tremendous movement to move away from Judaism, there was this fear that they really couldn't control it. After the situation was such that it was a fait accompli, that they had to, in other words, it wasn't really an option to continue on, at least for many of them, to traditional Jewish education, that it had for all basic purposes isolated themselves from general society, then they introduced it on their own, the rabbinic establishment on their own terms. And here we find, this is in later lectures, where we find again Sham Shulchan Aruch, even those before Sham Shulchan Aruch. Sham Shulchan Aruch had a great Rebbe, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, the author of the Orach Laner, the Binyan Siyan, who in Altona, which is a suburb of Hamburg, introduced himself a school with secular subjects, but he produced Gedolei Torah, produced great people. His colleague in Hamburg, Yitzhak Bernays, who was the Rebbe of Rav Sham Shulchan Hirsch, he and also Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, also produced such a school, because they felt at the time, this is already in the 1820s, 1830s, things had changed, and they no longer had that luxury, and it wasn't a question of preserving them, and if they didn't do anything, they would lose all of their children. So it basically was a decision based on practicality. But originally, they were basically afraid to make any to really to make any compromise.
Was he a Sephardi?
Yeah, you're asking Chacham Bernays was an Ashkenazi. We discussed this in a previous lecture. When he... No, I didn't. We'll put him this way. Chacham Bernays, when he took the position as a chief rabbi of Hamburg, felt that he had to put himself a title which would differentiate him from the old school rabbis and the rabbis who would become associated with the new school. Hamburg was a community that had a Sephardic community. In fact, Hamburg became the first Jews who came to Hamburg were Muranos, were Jews who had escaped from Portugal, who came and established a community. Later on, especially in after the massacres of Shnas Tach Batat and the Chmielnytsky uprising, there was a whole mass migration from Poland, from Russia, that came to Germany. So there grew an Ashkenazi community. But side by side, there was a Sephardic, a well-established and a well-respected community. He felt that he would take on that title and would give him a distinction. So that really a new... Chacham Bernays had a university education. And yet, he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham and a Yorei Shamayim, God-fearing. Sham Shaphol Hirsch was his student. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer heard lectures from sermons, lectures from he had a tremendous effect. So these were people that were that integrated this thing, and there were other communities as well. But other communities felt it was dangerous, and they didn't.
It seems from the commentary of the Bir HaGorah from the Roman Gomez, the Rambam was corrupted.
Yeah, you're asking the Rambam was corrupted. That's his opinion. In fact, there's a Girsa, there's from the original notes, or the first printing of the Bir HaGorah, and it was subsequently taken out. That it read is Philosophia Harura, the cursed philosophy. So he was not. Yeah, you're asking by the Bris. When we discussed the lectures on the Rambam, they took the Rambam's halachic approach, but not his philosophical approach.
Yeah. But if you don't believe
the you're asking about how the Rambam, he says. Right. You seem about the seeds of the Enlightenment. Yeah. This is all true. But according to the Rambam, he who takes the rationalist view is within the fold. He himself took this view, and that was Mendelssohn's view. From the camp who are the, let's say, the, we'll call them the literalists, who assume, like the Vilna Gaon, that all of this phenomenon is true. I don't know if they call those who deny it heretics, but they view them, they're out of the pale. This is... Okay, Gutterbach?
Yeah.